Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1211, I will have two segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and ongoing Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank. During the second segment, I will air Chris Hedges' speech delivered at Princeton University titled, Iran and Gaza are only the beginning. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 909 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine and Lebanon. Israel continues to shoot, attack, drone strike, and bomb Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, while maintaining a severe blockade on essential food, medicine, medical supplies, fuel, and materials for infrastructure repair. On Tuesday, March 31st, reporter Ibrahim Kanan captured footage of a Palestinian child who was injured in a bombing that targeted a group of Palestinians in the Bayouk area of Khan Yunis. Kanan stated that one man was killed along with his baby and others were injured. The local Wafa news agency reported that another Palestinian was killed and others were injured in a separate attack in Jabalia in northern Gaza, also on Tuesday, and two others were injured by Israeli gunfire east of the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli forces once again targeted Palestinian police checkpoints this week. Six Palestinians, including a young girl and three police officers, were killed in two separate Israeli strikes on police personnel on March 29th in the Mawasi area west of Khan Yunis. Over the past 3 weeks, Israel has routinely targeted Palestinian police officers in an effort to disrupt social order. Reporter Ibrahim Kanan said that the attack occurred along with artillery shelling and gunfire along the eastern areas of Khan Yunis city in the southern Gaza Strip. Two brothers were killed in an Israeli airstrike in the Shujaiya neighborhood of eastern Gaza City on March 28th, while they were directly confronting militias supported by Israel in defense of their home and their community. Journalist Ibrahim Bedouin accompanied a massive funeral march after Saad and Fahmi Kadoum were killed while foiling an incursion by the Israeli-aligned militias. The two brothers engaged the armed group in clashes, inflicting losses, before the Israeli occupation army sent a swarm of quadcopter drones and a warplane, which directly targeted them and killed them. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, more than 710 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,900 have been wounded since the so-called ceasefire began in October 2025. The Rafah crossing at the Gaza-Egypt border was partially reopened 2 weeks ago for a very limited number of Palestinians leaving for medical treatment and the return of those who sought treatment abroad during the last 2.5 years of Israel's genocide. This week, a group of small children who had been medically evacuated to Egypt in November 2023, most of them who were premature infants in incubators, were returned to their families. After Israel cut the power to hospitals and then started bombing medical facilities during the first few months of the genocide, 29 babies were transferred from the neonatal intensive care unit at Al-Shifa Hospital to other hospitals in Gaza before being evacuated. 4 of the babies in critical condition of the group died. And notably, of course, Israel prevented the parents from accompanying their fragile newborns. These mothers and fathers had not seen their children since November 2023. Dr. Munir Al-Bursh, the director of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, recalled on social media the story of what the infants were put through. He stated, quote, "Few know the story of the premature infants while we were besieged inside Al-Shifa Medical Complex. When fuel was cut off, incubators fell silent. and the smallest lives began fading before our eyes, one after another. They were unbearable moments, babies struggling to breathe, without machines, without warmth, without enough life to hold on to. We called upon the world, save those who remain before it is too late. We carried them through hospital corridors, searching for any chance of survival, in scenes broadcast live and documented by international organizations, yet the world was too late. In the end, those who survived were transferred to Egypt for treatment, carrying the pain of their beginnings and the hope of survival. Today, life returns, he added. In a follow-up post, Dr. Alberche said that doctors and healthcare workers, quote, paid a steep price to never abandon them and stayed with them until the very last moment. And today they have returned alive to their mother's embraces to declare to the world that the will to live is stronger than the will to kill, and that Gaza, despite the pain, forges glory and inscribes victory by the grace of God. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Civil Defense and the Ministry of Health in Gaza stated this week that the electricity and fuel crisis due to Israel's ongoing blockade is threatening to shut down health and emergency services if a sufficient amount of fuel is not delivered immediately. On March 31st, the Civil Defense issued an urgent appeal to pressure the Israelis to allow in fuel for critical rescue and repair operations. Journalist Ibrahim Badouan showed the result of the deepening shortage of fuel and spare parts that is threatening hospital generators and is pushing the healthcare system toward collapse amid ongoing power outages. The Civil Defense stated that with the limited amount of fuel that they have received, which they estimate covers only about 15% of their monthly requirements, the humanitarian crisis is becoming exacerbated across Gaza. The rescue workers warned that the Israeli occupation authorities are deliberately employing a drip-feed policy regarding the entry of fuel into the Gaza Strip, a tactic that negatively impacts humanitarian intervention efforts and intensifies the suffering of the civilian population. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a 15-year-old child in the Dehesha refugee camp south of Bethlehem on March 27th. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Adam Syed Salah Beit Dahman, 15 years old, was shot in the pelvis by Israeli forces around 9 p.m. at the entrance to Dehesha. Four Israeli military vehicles arrived at the camp's entrance 30 minutes prior to the shooting, and young Palestinian men and boys threw stones toward the heavily armored vehicles in response. Soldiers disembarked from their armored vehicles and opened fire from about 200 meters away, striking Adam. After shooting Adam, Israeli forces surrounded him while beating him and shouting at him. Israeli soldiers prevented Palestine Red Crescent Society paramedics from reaching the child for about 30 minutes, Defense for Children International Palestine stated. Israeli forces eventually allowed one paramedic to reach Adam. An ambulance brought him to Beit Jela Governmental Hospital, where he was pronounced dead at 10:30 p.m. Adam's mother carried her son's body through the camp during his funeral on March 28th. Reporter Hisham Abu Shakra captured this clip. Israeli forces have killed 8 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2026, according to documentation collected by DCIP. Israeli forces and settlers killed 56 Palestinian children in the West Bank in 2025. Jewish Israeli settlers attacked a group of Palestinians on Tuesday in the town of Taisir in the northern West Bank, injuring at least 3. Eyewitnesses told the Anadolu news agency that the settlers attacked Palestinians on their land on the outskirts of the town, assaulting them with stones and sticks. The Israelis set fire to a tractor and other Palestinian property in the town, they added. After decades of Israel's de facto policy of killing Palestinians by torture, starvation, or denial of medical treatment inside prisons and detention camps, the Israeli parliament codified the policy into law this week, passing a measure that allows the execution of Palestinians by hanging, carried out by prison guards appointed by the Israeli prison service, with the identities of the executors kept secret and granted legal immunity. The law enjoys broad support from the Israeli public, notes human rights group B'Tselem. The Palestinian civil rights group Adala states that the law establishes, quote, clear racial separation, applying it exclusively to the Palestinian population of the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and excluding the Israeli Jewish population. Adala submitted a petition against the law just half an hour after the Israeli parliament passed it, according to the center's director, Hassan Jabarin. The law is racist, Jabarin told the Anadolu news agency. While many countries apply the death penalty, the statute is the only law in the world that discriminates between defendants based on ethnicity, he added. Israel's national security minister, extremist, settler, and war crimes suspect Itamar Ben-Gvir, a leading proponent of the measure who has been wearing a noose pin on his lapel in support, celebrated the passage of the law by opening up a bottle of champagne and toasting to the prospect of killing more Palestinians with his fellow lawmakers. More than 9,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 350 children and 73 women who are subjected to systematic torture, starvation, and medical neglect, practices that have escalated since the genocide began in October 2023. A general strike was announced across the occupied West Bank in protest of the execution law as Palestinians in Gaza protested in the streets. Reporter Mohammed Abu Salama captured video of crowds of demonstrators in Gaza holding signs against the law and burning photos of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. A spokesperson for the tribes and popular committees in Burej refugee camp in Gaza told the Anadolu news agency that the protest aimed, quote, to send a clear message to the occupation that the prisoners are not alone. Adopting such laws reflects confusion and failure, he said, stressing that tribal leaders declare that, quote, any harm to our prisoners will be met with an unexpected popular and national response. He emphasized that Palestinians stand united behind the prisoners' cause. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, at least 50 people were killed and nearly 200 were wounded between Tuesday and Wednesday alone, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Since the Israeli attacks escalated on March 2nd, more than 1,300 Lebanese have been killed and nearly 4,000 have been wounded. In the south, Israel killed three journalists on March 28th while they were covering the Israeli invasion and attacks. Fatima Fatouni, a reporter for Al Mayadeen, was killed along with her brother, Mohammed, a video journalist, and Ali Shweb, a longtime correspondent with Al Manar TV. Their vehicle was clearly marked press, and Fatima Fatouni had just ended her live broadcast right before the airstrike killed her. In an attempt to supposedly justify the killing, Israeli forces claimed that Shweb was a member of Hezbollah's Radwan forces, a special operations arm of the military, echoing a tactic that Israel has used to justify the targeted murders of hundreds of Palestinian journalists in Gaza over the last 2.5 years of genocide. The military claimed that he worked to expose the locations of Israeli army troops operating in southern Lebanon in their invasion and occupation there, and that he engaged in incitement against Israeli troops, reports the publication Truthout. However, the only evidence the military offered was a photo of Shweb, a well-known war reporter who has covered the region for decades in supposed military garb. When a Fox News correspondent asked the Israeli military about the source of the photo, the military admitted that it was fake. Unfortunately, there isn't really a picture of it. It was photoshopped, the Israeli military said in a statement. In a post mourning their colleague Fatima Fatouni, Al-Mayadeen says that it was not the first time that one of their correspondents had been targeted by Israel. Quote, soon after Israel began its war on Lebanon, Al-Mayadeen's correspondent Farah Omar and cameraman Rabih Memari were martyred in an Israeli aggression on November 21, 2023. Al-Mayadeen's Ghassan Najjar and Mohammed Reda were also martyred in another Israeli attack on journalists on October 25th, 2024. This is part of Israel's systematic attacks on journalists, Al-Mayadeen added. Quote, in the past 3 years, Israel has killed hundreds of journalists across the region, all in an attempt to prevent the broadcasting of the reality of its crimes. For more on the situation in Lebanon over the past few days, our contributor Rokaya Chamsedine filed this report for the Electronic Intifada on Wednesday evening.
Last week, Israeli forces have significantly escalated their military offensive against Lebanon, once again striking deep into residential neighborhoods and rural communities. Air raids and attacks from Israeli warships have targeted Beirut's southern suburb, also known as Dahiya, resulting in significant casualties. In southern Lebanon, the intensity of strikes continues unabated. Villages including Khiam, Jibshit, Kafra, Bint Jbin, and Tibnin, among others, have been hit repeatedly by Israeli bombardment. Homes, shops, and community centers have been damaged or completely destroyed, and dozens have been killed or wounded. Israel is also continuing with its pattern of attacking medical personnel, including by way of double-tap strikes. To date, Israel has killed 1,318 people and injured 3,935 people in Lebanon since the 2nd of March. Among those killed are more than 55 first responders. Arguably, the most harrowing loss have been the deaths of journalist Haj Ali Shaib of Al Manar and Al Mayadeen's Fatma Ftouneh, along with her brother, photojournalist Mohammed Ftouneh, who were killed when their clearly marked press vehicle was struck by at least four Israeli missiles while they were covering the situation in South Lebanon near the village of Jizin. In reaction to these sustained assaults, Hezbollah has intensified resistance operations against Israeli military positions, conducting coordinated rocket barrages and precision strikes. Armed resistance units have targeted Israeli armored columns and outposts along the border regions, engaging occupation forces with guided missiles and unmanned aerial strikes designed to disrupt troop concentrations and logistical lines. Hezbollah has also targeted over 120 Israeli tanks and military machinery and have been facing Israeli soldiers from point-blank range. These operations, which have resulted in an unknown number of dead Israeli occupation soldiers, are part of a broader strategy of active defense, resisting any attempt by Israeli forces to advance into southern Lebanon and asserting our people's right to defend Lebanese territory in the face of foreign aggression. Southern villages near the border have seen repeated Israeli announcements of the intention to bomb our communities, but many residents refuse to abandon their homes and land, choosing instead to stand firm despite the bombardment. Hezbollah has made it clear that resistance operations will continue as long as Israeli attacks on Lebanese civilians and sovereign territory persist. Hezbollah's leadership has reiterated that actions taken are in direct response to the occupation's military operations against the people of Lebanon. Each new day in Lebanon brings fresh reports of an attack on a village and neighborhood and of families mourning loved ones, but also of resistance and of Hezbollah units engaging in defensive operations along the front lines. The struggle continues with intensity, driven by a determination to protect our land, our people, and the right to self-defense against Israeli aggression. The people of Dahiya, South Lebanon, and the Ba'a Valley are still here, and they continue to resist.
That was Rokaya Chamsedine reporting for the Electronic Intifada from Lebanon on Wednesday. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight A Genocide Here, An Amputation There by Ahmed Dremli and Huda Skeik, writing from Gaza, with photography by Omar Ashtawi and Mu'tasim Al-Bitar. The reporters profile several Palestinians in this moving feature who are trying to cope with amputations and other injuries after surviving Israeli attacks during the genocide. One of the stories they follow is that of Omar Halawa, 13 years old, who lives with his family in a displacement camp after their home in the Jabalia refugee camp was destroyed in an Israeli airstrike in January 2024. The reporters write, quote, "On October 1st, 2025, Omar and two of his cousins were waiting for a charity water truck near their tent on Gaza City's beach. At around 8 a.m., Israeli shells began to strike in the area of the water queue, two shells landing near Omar. Omar's parents, Yasmin and Adnan, heard the explosions from inside their tent, followed by shrapnel hitting nearby. Adnan rushed outside when, moments later, three young men ran toward their tent, asking if they were Omar's parents. They told us he was injured in his leg and had been taken to the hospital, Yasmin, 37, told the Electronic Intifada. I screamed, and his father kept slapping his face, unable to believe what he was hearing. Yasmin ran barefoot nearly 3 kilometers toward Al-Shifa Hospital and then to the nearby patient's friend's Benevolent Society Hospital, but didn't find Omar in either. Doctors at the patient's friend's hospital told Yasmin he might have been transferred to the Palestine Red Crescent Society Field Hospital in central Gaza City. She trekked there while praying he was alive, Yasmin said. I went in screaming, "Where is my son? Where is Omar?" A doctor carrying a cardboard box approached her. He told me, "Your son is in surgery. This is his leg." Yasmin fainted. After Omar woke from surgery, he felt an absence in the lower half of his body. He told the Electronic Intifada that the first shell had just hit meters from his cousins Hamoud and Muadh, pushing them up into the air. In an instant, he heard the whistle of a second shell before he was thrown to the ground and lost consciousness. "When I opened my eyes, I saw my legs covered in blood," Omar said. "I tried to pull myself away and crawl, but I fainted again. I woke up to find myself in the hospital. My right leg was amputated. The other was seriously injured." Although Yasmin tried to hide the appalling news, Omar later learned that his cousins, both of them also 13, were killed. "I wish I had died with them," he said. "I keep thinking about how they are gone." After a week, Omar returned to the tent where his parents wheel him daily to the Artificial Limbs and Polio Center in eastern Gaza City for physiotherapy. The family has appealed on social media and asked doctors about getting him a prosthetic limb. They were told they are not available in Gaza due to the Israeli restrictions on movement in and out of Gaza. "I wish I could walk again without crutches," Omar said. "I can't sleep at night. I keep thinking about that day and about my life now as an amputee without a prosthetic." Omar is among at least 6,000 amputation cases that require urgent long-term rehabilitation programs, according to the Ministry of Health in Gaza, as of December 2025. Of the 6,000, 25% are children, like Omar. Gaza has the largest number of child amputees worldwide, according to UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. Those are excerpts from A Genocide Here, An Amputation There by Ahmed Dremli and Huda Skake, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. Hundreds of runners, some of them barefoot, participated in the first marathon race in Gaza since the start of the genocide in 2023. They ran past enormous mountains of rubble where homes used to be, as well as areas that are slowly returning to life. Reporter Selma Kadoumi captured this clip of the race. She says, quote, "The first marathon in the Gaza Strip kicked off after a 3-year hiatus with around 500 participants. The race started from the entrance of Al Burej refugee camp and continued to the city of Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip, where participants covered a distance of 4 kilometers. That's from Selma Kadoumi in Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On March 25, 2026, Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist, whom I've interviewed on this program before, delivered a speech at Princeton University titled "Iran and Gaza Are Only the Beginning." I'm going to share his speech with you, and the recording comes to us from the Chris Hedges Report. Let's listen in.
Thank you for inviting me. I have just finished with the cartoonist Joe Sacco. I hope you know his work. Palestine, Footnotes in Gaza, a book on the genocide. We interviewed 29 families in Egypt from Gaza. and have spent the last year writing the story of the genocide through their experiences. We literally turned in the manuscript a week ago, which is why, if I look burned out, I am burned out. It'll be published in October. But I didn't want to speak about the book, given what's happening as I speak in southern Lebanon, in Iran, and in Gaza. I wanted to speak a little more globally today. The genocide in Gaza is the beginning. Welcome to the New World Order, the age of technologically advanced barbarism. There are no rules for the strong, only for the weak. Oppose the strong, refuse to bow to its capricious demands, and you are showered with missiles and bombs. We watch this madness daily with the war on Iran, the saturation bombing of southern Lebanon, and the suffering in Gaza. International bodies, such as the United Nations, have been neutered, transformed into useless appendages of another age. The sanctity of individual rights, open borders, and international law have vanished. The most psychopathic rulers of human history, those who reduced cities to ashes, herded captive populations to execution sites, and littered lands they occupied with mass graves and corpses, have returned with a vengeance, opening up a vast moral abyss. The law, despite a few valiant efforts by a handful of judges who will soon be purged domestically and in international bodies such as the International Court of Justice, is contemptuously violated. Savagery abroad, savagery at home. The BBC's Lucy Williamson reports that Israel is destroying South Lebanon, and I quote, using Gaza as a model, a blueprint for destruction used again as a path to peace, end quote. Over 1 million people have already been displaced in Lebanon. 1/5 of the entire population of a country that already hosts the world's highest number of refugees per capita in just a few weeks. Add to this 2 million displaced in Gaza and 3 million displaced in Iran. 6 million people rendered homeless. For 4 decades, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been lobbying for the U.S. to go to war with Iran. Previous administrations, Republican and Democrat, have refused, in no small part because of fierce opposition within the Pentagon, which did not view Iran as an existential threat and did not project a positive outcome for the United States or its allies. But Donald Trump, encouraged by his inept negotiating team of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and fellow real estate developer and golfing partner, Steve Witkoff, each fervent Zionist, took the bait. Joseph Kent, who resigned his position as director of the National Counterterrorism Center to protest the war, wrote in his resignation letter that, quote, Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. The public rationale for the war on Iran since it began on February 28th has been protean. Is it to shut down Iran's nuclear program? Is it to thwart Iran's ballistic missile program? Is it because the U.S. carried out preemptive attacks on Iran, as Marco Rubio said, to ensure the safety of U.S. assets once Israel decided to strike? Is it because the Iranian government carried out lethal repression, killing hundreds of anti-government protesters during massive street protests? Is it regime change? Is it an attempt to shut down Iran's so-called state-sponsored terrorism? Or are these subterfuges for something else? Certainly Israel and the U.S. seek regime change, but here it appears the U.S. and Israel diverge. Israel also apparently seeks, as in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Lebanon, the physical disintegration of Iran, the breaking apart of the country into warring ethnic and religious enclaves, the transformation of Iran into a failed state. Persians in Iran, where I worked frequently, constitute roughly 61% of the population, with various minority groups who often suffer state repression making up the remaining 39%. These ethnic groups include Azerbaijanis, Kurds, Lurs, Balochs, Arabs, and Turkmens, along with religious minorities such as Sunnis, Christians, Baha'i, Zoroastrians, and Jews. The shattering of Iran into antagonistic ethnic and religious enclaves would leave Israel as the dominant power in the region, giving it the ability to, if not occupy its neighbors, then directly control and subjugate them through proxies, part of a long-held desire for greater Israel. It would also make it possible for foreign states to control Iranian gas reserves, the second largest in the world, and its oil reserves, 12% of the global total. Israel's crusade against the Palestinians, the Lebanese, and now the Iranians is justified by the extermination of 6 million Jews during the Holocaust. But it is not lost on the global South, especially Palestinians, that nearly all Holocaust scholars have refused to condemn the genocide in Gaza. Not one of the institutions dedicated to researching and commemorating the Holocaust have drawn the obvious historical parallels or decried the mass slaughter. Holocaust scholars, with a handful of exceptions, have exposed their true purpose, which is not to examine the dark side of human nature and the frightening propensity we all have to commit evil, but to sanctify Jews as eternal victims and absolve the ethno-nationalist state of Israel of its crimes of settler colonialism, apartheid, and genocide. The hijacking of the Holocaust, the failure to defend Palestinian victims because they are Palestinian, has imploded the moral authority of Holocaust scholars and Holocaust memorials. They have been exposed as vehicles not to prevent genocide, but to perpetuate it, not to explore the past, but manipulate the present. Any tepid recognition that the Holocaust may not be the exclusive property of Israel and its Zionist supporters is swiftly shut down. The Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles deleted an Instagram post that read, "Never again can't only mean never again for Jews," after a backlash. In the hands of Zionists, never again means precisely that, never again only for Jews. Ami Cesar, in Discourse on Colonialism, which you have, if you haven't read it, you should read it, writes that Hitler seemed exceptionally cruel, only because he presided over, quote, "the humiliation of the white man," applying to Europe the colonialist procedures which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the quote unquote coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. The near annihilation of Tasmania's aboriginal population, the German slaughter of the Herero and Namaqua, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943, then British Prime Minister Winston Churchill referred to Hindus as, quote, "a beastly people with a beastly religion," along with the dropping of nuclear bombs on civilian targets in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, illustrates something fundamental about Western civilization. Genocide is not an anomaly. It is coded within our DNA. In America, the poet Langston Hughes said, "Negroes do not have to be told what fascism is in action. We know. Its theories of Nordic supremacy and economic suppression have long been realities to us." The Nazis, when they formulated the Nuremberg Laws, modeled them on laws designed to disenfranchise blacks. America's refusal to grant citizenship to Native Americans and Filipinos, although they lived in the US and US territories, was emulated by the German fascists who stripped citizenship from Jews. American anti-miscegenation laws, which criminalized interracial marriage, were the impetus to outlaw marriages between German Jews and Aryans. American jurisprudence classified anyone with 1% of black ancestry, the so-called one-drop rule, as black. The Nazis, ironically, showing more flexibility, classified anyone with three or more Jewish grandparents as Jewish. The millions of indigenous victims of colonial projects in countries such as Mexico, China, India, Australia, the Congo, and Vietnam, for this reason, are deaf to the fatuous claims by Zionists that their victimhood is unique. They too suffered Holocausts, but these Holocausts remain minimized or unacknowledged by their Western perpetrators. Israel embodies the ethno-nationalist state our own Christian fascists and the far right dream of creating for themselves, one that rejects political and cultural pluralism as well as legal, diplomatic, and ethical norms. Israel is admired by the far right because it has turned its back on humanitarian law and uses indiscriminate lethal force to cleanse its society of those condemned as human contaminants. It was this distortion of the Holocaust that troubled Primo Levi, who was imprisoned in Auschwitz from 1944 to 1945 and who wrote Survival in Auschwitz. Levi was a fierce critic of the apartheid state of Israel and its treatment of Palestinians. He saw the Shoah as, quote, an inexhaustible source of evil that is perpetuated as hatred in the survivors and springs up in a thousand ways against the very will of all, as a thirst for revenge, as moral breakdown, as negation, as weariness, as resignation. Levi deplored the Manichaeism of those who shun nuance and complexity. He condemned those who reduce the river of human events to conflicts and conflicts to duels, us and them. He warned that the network of human relationships inside the concentration camps was not simple. It could not be reduced to two blocks, victims and perpetrators. The enemy, he knew, was outside, but also inside. Mordecai Chaim Rumkowski, known as King Chaim, ruled in the Lodz ghetto in Poland on behalf of the Nazi occupiers. The ghetto became a slave labor camp that enriched Rumkowski and his Nazi masters. Rumkowski deported opponents to death camps. He raped and molested girls and women. He demanded unquestioned obedience. He embodied the evil of his oppressors. For Levi, he was an example of what many of us, under similar circumstances, are capable of becoming. We are all mirrored in Rumkowski. His ambiguity is ours. It is our second nature, we hybrids, molded from clay and spirit, Levi wrote in The Drowned and the Saved. His fever is ours, the fever of our Western civilization that descends into hell with trumpets and drums, and its miserable adornments are the distorting image of our symbols of social prestige. Like Rumkowski, we too are so dazzled by power and prestige as to forget our essential fragility, Levi continues. Willingly or not, we come to terms with power, forgetting that we are all in the ghetto, that the ghetto is walled in, that outside the ghetto reign the lords of death, and that close by the train is waiting. Levi understood that the line between the victim and the victimizer is razor thin. We can all become willing executioners. There is nothing intrinsically moral about being Jewish or a survivor of the Holocaust. And Levi, for this reason, was persona non grata in Israel. Zionists find in the Holocaust and the Jewish state a sense of purpose and meaning, as well as a cloying moral superiority. After the 1967 war, when Israel seized Gaza, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, Syria's Golan Heights, and Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, Israel, as American sociologist Nathan Glazer approvingly observed, became, quote, the religion of the American Jews. The Holocaust became their moral capital. Jewish suffering is depicted as ineffable, uncommunicable, and yet always to be proclaimed, writes the European historian Charles Mayer in The Unmasterable Past, History, Holocaust, and German National Identity. It is intensely private, not to be diluted, but simultaneously public, so that genteel society will confirm the crimes. A very peculiar suffering must be enshrined in public sites, Holocaust museums, memory gardens, deportation sites, dedicated not as Jewish, but civic memorials. But what is the role of a museum in a country such as the United States, far from the site of the Holocaust? Is it to rally the people who suffer, or to instruct non-Jews? Is it supposed to serve as a reminder that it can happen here? Or is it a statement that some special consideration is deserved? Under what circumstances can a private sorrow serve simultaneously as a public grief? And if genocide is certified as a public sorrow, then must we not accept the credentials of other particular sorrows too? An American historian of Polish ancestry argues that with the German invasion of 1939, the Poles became the first people in Europe to experience the Holocaust, and that historians have so far chosen to interpret the tragedy in exclusivist terms, namely, as the most tragic period in the history of the Jewish diaspora. If Polish Americans claim that their own quote-unquote forgotten Holocaust, what recognition should they enjoy? Do Armenians and Cambodians also have a right to publicly funded Holocaust museums? And do we need memorials to Seventh-day Adventists and homosexuals for their persecution at the hands of the Third Reich? Unique suffering confers unique entitlement. Any crime Israel carries out in the name of its survival, its right to exist, is justified in the name of this uniqueness. There are no limits. The world is black and white, a never-ending battle against Nazism, which is protean, depending on who Israel targets. To challenge this bloodlust is to be an anti-Semite, facilitating another genocide of Jews. This simplistic formula not only serves the interests of Israel, but also the interests of colonial powers that carried out their own genocides, ones they also seek to obscure. The sacralization of the Nazi Holocaust offers a bizarre quid pro quo. Arming and funding the State of Israel, blocking UN resolutions and sanctions that would condemn its crimes, and demonizing Palestinians and their supporters becomes proof of atonement and support for Jews. Israel, in return, absolves the West for its indifference to the plight of Jews during the Holocaust, and Germany for perpetrating it. Germany uses this unholy alliance to separate Nazism from the rest of German history, including the genocide German colonists carried out against the Nama and Herero in German Southwest Africa, now Namibia. Such magic, the Israeli historian and genocide scholar Roz Siegel writes, legitimizes racism against Palestinians at the very moment that Israel perpetrates genocide against them. The idea of Holocaust uniqueness thus reproduces, rather than challenges, the exclusionary nationalism and settler colonialism that led to the Holocaust. Professor Siegel, the director of the program in Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University in New Jersey, wrote an article about the war on Gaza on October 13, 2023, titled, "A Textbook Case of Genocide." This denunciation from an Israeli Holocaust scholar whose family members perished in the Holocaust was a very lonely stance. Professor Siegel saw in the Israeli government's immediate demand that Palestinians evacuate the north of Gaza and the blood-curdling demonization of the Palestinians by Israeli officials. The defense minister said Israel was fighting quote-unquote human animals, the stench of genocide. The whole idea about prevention and never again is that, as we teach our students, there are red flags, that once we notice them, we're supposed to work in order to stop the process that could escalate to genocide, Professor Siegel told me, even if it's not genocidal yet. Holocaust studies as a field might be dead, which is not necessarily a bad thing, he continued, if indeed Holocaust studies is intertwined from the beginning with the ideology of global Holocaust memory. Maybe it's good that we won't have Holocaust studies anymore, and maybe it will open the door for even more interesting and important research on the Holocaust as history, as real history. Professor Siegel paid for his honesty. The offer to lead the University of Minnesota's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, which has issued no condemnation of the genocide, was revoked. When Professor Siegel and I testified at the state capitol in Trenton, in opposition to the adoption of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA bill, which equates criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism, we were jeered by Zionists, and our microphones were cut by the committee chairman. There we were, arguing that this bill would curtail free speech while we were, in real time, being denied free speech. Genocide is the next stage in what the anthropologist Arjun Appadure calls, quote, a vast worldwide Malthusian correction that is geared to preparing the world for the winners of globalization, minus the inconvenient noise of the losers. The funding and arming of Israel by the United States and European allies, as it carries out genocide, has effectively imploded the post-World War II international legal order. It no longer has credibility. The West can no longer lecture anyone about democracy, human rights, or the supposed virtues of Western civilization. The ruse that somehow we as a nation promote democracy, equality, and human rights is finished. At the same time that Gaza induces vertigo, a feeling of chaos and emptiness, it becomes for countless powerless people the essential condition of political and ethical consciousness in the 21st century, just as the First World War was for a generation in the West, Pankaj Mishra writes. None of us who reported from Israel and Palestine, where I worked as a reporter for 7 years, predicted this genocide. And yet, we were acutely aware of the genocidal impulse that lay at the heart of the Zionist project, the desire by large segments of Israeli society to eradicate and expel all Palestinians. This genocidal impulse was there from the inception of Zionism. Viktor Klemperer, a professor of linguistics and the son of a Berlin rabbi living under Nazi rule, noted in his diary, quote, "To me, the Zionists who want to go back to the Jewish state of 70 AD, the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus, are just as offensive as the Nazis, with their nosing after blood, their ancient cultural roots, their partly canting, partly obtuse, winding back of the world. They are altogether a match for the National Socialists." I covered the extremist rabbi, Meir Kahana, who claimed that violence was a Jewish virtue and revenge a divine commandment. He was, when I was based in Jerusalem, barred by the Israeli government from running for office. Kahana was assassinated on November 5th, 1990, in New York City. His Koch party in Israel was outlawed 4 years later after Baruch Goldstein, a Brooklyn-born doctor and Koch member, entered Hebron's Ibrahimi Mosque and opened fire on worshipers, killing 29 Palestinians, an event I covered for the New York Times. Goldstein, dressed in his army captain's uniform, was overpowered by worshipers and beaten to death. Koch, following its statements of support for the massacre, was declared a terrorist organization by the United States. But Kahanaism didn't die. It was nurtured by Jewish extremists and colonists. Koch's racial intolerance and calls for mass violence against Palestinians infected larger and larger segments of Israeli society. I saw this intolerance at political rallies held by Netanyahu, who received lavish funding from right-wing Americans associated with AIPAC when he ran against Yitzhak Rabin, who was negotiating a peace settlement with the Palestinians. Netanyahu's supporters chanted Kahana-inspired slogans such as "Death to Arabs" and "Death to Rabin." They burned an effigy of Rabin dressed in a Nazi uniform. Netanyahu marched in front of a mock funeral for Rabin, and Rabin was assassinated by a Jewish fanatic on November 4th, 1995. Netanyahu, who first became prime minister in 1996, has spent his political career nurturing these Jewish extremists, including Itamar Ben-Gavir, who hung a portrait of Goldstein on the wall of his living room, Bezalel Smotrich, Avigdor Lieberman, Gideon Sarar, Naftali Bennett, and others. Netanyahu's father, Ben-Zion, who worked as an assistant to the founder of revisionist Zionism, Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was referred to by Benito Mussolini, and I quote, as a good fascist, was a leader in the Herut Party that called on Israel to seize all of the land of historic Palestine. Many of those who formed the Herut Party carried out terrorist attacks during the 1948 war that established the State of Israel. Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, Sidney Hook, and other Jewish intellectuals described the Herut Party in a statement published in the New York Times as a party, quote, closely akin in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to Nazi and fascist parties. There has always been a virulent strain of Jewish fascism within the Zionist project, mirroring the strain of fascism in American society. Unfortunately for us and the Palestinians, these fascistic strains are ascendant. The decision to obliterate Gaza has long been the dream of far-right Zionists, heirs of Kahana's movement. Jewish identity and Jewish nationalism are the Zionist versions of the Nazis' blood and soil ideology. Jewish supremacy is sanctified by God, as is the slaughter of the Palestinians who Netanyahu compared to the biblical Amalekites who were massacred by the Israelites. Europeans and Euro-Americans in the American colonies use the same biblical passage to justify their genocide against Native Americans. Enemies, usually Muslims, who are slated for extinction are subhumans who embody evil. Violence and the threat of violence are the only forms of communication those outside the magical circle of Jewish nationalism understand. Messianic redemption will take place once the Palestinians are expelled. Jewish extremists call for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of three of the most sacred sites for Muslims, supposedly built on the ruins of the Jewish Second Temple, which was destroyed by the Roman army in 70 AD, to be demolished. These extremists call for it to be replaced by a third Jewish temple, a move that would set the Muslim world alight. The West Bank, which zealots refer to as Judea and Samaria, is being annexed, as I speak, by Israel. Israel, governed by religious laws imposed by ultra-Orthodox Shas and United Torah Judaism parties, will soon mirror the despotic theocracy in Iran. James Baldwin presciently saw this regression to our innate barbarism. And just the students here, if you have not read James Baldwin, you don't understand America. He warned that there was a, quote, terrible probability that Western populations, struggling to hold on to what they have stolen from their captives and unable to look into their mirror, will precipitate a chaos throughout the world, which, if it does not bring life on this planet to an end, will bring about a racial war as the world has never seen, and for which generations yet unborn will curse our names forever. The savagery in Iran, Lebanon, and Gaza is the same savagery we face at home. Those carrying out the genocide, mass slaughter, and unprovoked war on Iran are the same people dismantling our democratic institutions. The Iranians, Lebanese, and Palestinians know there is no appeasing these monsters. The global elites believe nothing. They feel nothing. They cannot be trusted. They exhibit the core traits of all psychopaths: superficial charm, grandiosity and self-importance, a need for constant stimulation, a penchant for lying, deception, manipulation, and the inability to feel remorse or guilt. They disdain as weakness the virtues of empathy, honesty, compassion, and self-sacrifice. They live by the creed of me, me, me. The fact that millions of people share the same vices does not make these vices virtues. The fact that they share so many errors does not make the errors to be truths. And the fact that millions of people share the same forms of mental pathology does not make these people sane, Eric Fromm writes in The Sane Society. We have witnessed evil for nearly 3 years in Gaza. We watch it now in Iran. We watch it in Lebanon. We see this evil excused or masked by political leaders and the media. The New York Times, in a page out of Orwell, sent an internal memo telling reporters and editors to eschew the terms refugee camps, occupied territory, ethnic cleansing, and of course, genocide when writing about Gaza. Those who name and denounce this evil, including the heroic students who set up encampments on campuses here, Princeton, and even abroad, are smeared, blacklisted, and purged. They are arrested and deported. A deadening silence is descending upon us, the silence of all authoritarian states. We know where this ends. Fail to do your duty. Fail to cheerlead the war on Iran. Speak out against the crime of genocide and see your broadcasting license revoked as Trump's chair of the FCC, Brendan Carr, has proposed. We have enemies. They are not in Palestine. They are not in Lebanon. They are not in Iran. They are here among us. They dictate our lives. They are traitors to our ideals, and they are traitors to our country. They envision a world of slaves and masters, and Gaza is only the start. There are no internal mechanisms for reform. We can obstruct or surrender. These are the only choices left. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist, speaking at Princeton University on March 25, 2026. His talk was titled, Iran and Gaza Are Only the Beginning. You can find more about Chris Hedges and his work at chrishedges.substack.com. And we have a link to that on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.